Welcome to the Bloody Disgusting Network. The ensuing show will change, transform, and otherwise alter you. Good luck.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you. But if you wanna make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you.
Ring, ring, ring. Greetings, constant listeners, and welcome to the Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast. I'm your host, Michael Motorola Rothman, and ready to answer the call. No, not from Paul Feig's Ghostbusters, but from Mr. Harrigan's phone on Wednesday, which is today when we're recording. Netflix dropped the latest Stephen King movie, the second of this year since Dobbs Lot dissipated from Warner Brothers' schedule, and it comes from director John Lee Hancock, director of films like Saving Mr. Banks, starring Thomas World War II Hanks, The Founder, starring Michael Beetlejuice, Batman, Birdman, Keaton, and our favorite bit that has yet to be buried 6 feet under like Harrigan, The Highwayman. But how does he fare in King's Dominion? That's for us to sort out on today's episode. And we even have a special interview with the film star. Not Donald Sutherland, but Jaden Martell, who we all remember as Bill Dembro from It and It Chapter 2 and Rest Assured. Jaden and I talk a little bit about that film, those films, I should say, and more. So stick around for that. But right now, it is time to introduce our panel, because much to Mr. Harrigan's chagrin, I'm not alone here in the Harlow Cemetery. Joining me at the old Grouch's grave are two losers ready to stop texting and ready to start talking. Randall, say hello and tell us the first time you got an iPhone. The laziest prompt.
It's so funny you said that, because I'm literally texting at this moment my wife, because I'm like, I'm recording, so be quiet when you come in.
The power of the iPhone allows you to do this.
So when you said stop texting, I thought you were like really reprimanding me. I was like, how did he know? I thought I was being quiet about it. Hey, it's rockin' Razor Colburn.
Was that your first cell phone?
No, I've always been way behind on phones. I actually lost a job. Like I lost a job once that I was supposed to get because my phone was so shitty. The battery, like this was like an old, this is way, way, way pre-smartphones, like early 2000s. Yeah. The battery that was connected to the back of it wouldn't latch properly. So it would fall out all the time. And like my voicemail was broken or something. And I literally like this one guy, like I was so desperate for a job this one summer. And then like a year later, I saw this guy and he's like, and I was like, oh yeah, I wish I, you know, thanks for not hiring me, asshole, you know? And then he was like, he's like, I literally called you and offered you the job. And this is like, you know, before people would like email about this shit. You know what I mean? So anyways, I didn't get an iPhone until like, God, like 2011, 2012.
Oh,
like
wow.
I always had just a flip phone until then. I was broke. Like I couldn't afford one. And my friends all had them and I called them internet phones. And I thought I was such a clever old man. And then now, of course, I fucking love it. So I'm like Mr. Harrigan. I'm as addicted as anyone
else. I was going to say, yeah. I mean, were you doing
as much
your stocks?
As I scream about how it's literally destroyed, like it's completely fried all of our fucking brains. Like,
oh, absolutely.
We all have ADHD now, all of us, literally all of us. And it is because of that.
Wait a second. I got to go to my iPhone. I need to play with it. No, you're right. You're completely right. And I think, you know, we're definitely going to be talking about the techno obsession.
Yeah, that's where I think the most interesting stuff in this movie is kind of what, and it's the same stuff King was saying. I mean, this is a pretty, you know, page to screen adaptation. Pretty faithful,
easily.
So anyways, I'm rambling. Yeah.
Well, no, it's fine. It's good to ramble because that's what we do on iPhones, and that's what we do here on this podcast, the Losers Club podcast. And it wouldn't be the Losers Club if we didn't have at least two more losers on this episode, but we've got three, and the third, lucky number three, coming down from Nashville. Do they allow iPhones down there? And if so, what's your origin with them, Jen?
They do allow iPhones down here, but the content's all messed up. This is Jen Adam. And I don't remember the first time I got an iPhone, but I do remember the first time I destroyed my iPhone.
Oh.
We down here, we get like maybe one or two snows a year. So it like destroys everybody's ability to function. And so my car was in our garage for like 10 days and the battery died. And it was an old used Prius. And apparently Priuses have a secret engine in the back. So when you jump them, you have to like dismantle a section of the back. So we were trying to figure out how to do this and looking on YouTube on my iPhone. And once we found it, we put it on top of the roof and just completely forgot about it. So later we were like, where's my phone? And I hiked back down Old Hickory Boulevard and found it all smashed to shit.
Oh no. Road.
So yeah, we had to get a new one that day.
So you were looking up YouTube tutorials. What are you, Charlie from Fairy Tale?
I was Charlie.
You got you're going to go see Mr. Bowditch instead of Mr. Harrigan. Yeah.
Well, I mean the DNA between those two stories.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, just watching it today, I'm like, Jesus Christ, it's so similar.
I know.
I should say rewatching it. I think I'm the first person. I beat everyone. I got to watch it twice.
I watched it twice as well because I reviewed it. So
this is true. This is true. Once. Well, look, you're not in the twice Harrigan's club. A very sad
no jacket
club
for
we
me.
We probably are the only ones, though. Me and
I'm pretty sure, yeah. Unless we're talking about John Lee Hancock, which we'll talk about soon. I'm sure he's seen it more than once. Maybe not, though. As for me, iPhones, Jesus, I don't remember the first time I got an iPhone. I certainly remember the first time I saw an iPhone. It was this kid I grew up with, Brennan. Brennan Dunn, he was always ahead of the curve, kind of like the Joker. And he managed to get an iPhone like early on. And I remember looking at it and being like, what the fuck is this? And not knowing that, as Randall mentioned before, that it was going to take over the world and be my best friend. Because I think we all have relationships with our phones, and that's something we'll digress in. But I do have a fun story about when I broke my first iPhone, and it was very fitting. Because it was at the screening for Black Hat, which, if you know that movie, is all about, you know, being as technologically advanced as possible. And it's about a hacker played by Chris Hemsworth. Because when I think of hackers, I think of two things, Johnny Lee Miller and Chris Hemsworth. But I remember we were getting set for the movie. I was sitting with Justin and I went to go reach for something on the ground and my phone broke and smashed, and it just felt so fitting. It was like we just finished watching this movie that's literally about hacking and literally about just everyone being on their phones, and then for me to shatter my phone just by it falling out of my pocket, just it
did
felt
your,
right.
Did the screen like turn black after you broke it?
It did, and there was a
it was like a bit of a black phone situation.
A little black hat come out.
Hashtag Ethan Hawk. Yeah, well, it was a little scary too, because I had to go home with not being able to text all my friends. So
how did you get there? How did you survive?
I really don't know, and I don't know how I survived without it. Map. Oh God, printing
printed
out
the directions
maps.
Out at the theater.
Yeah, I stopped at like an Office Depot that was nearby, and I said, "Excuse me, sir, this is my address. Can you please print out a MapQuest for me?" And he did. Well, anyway, look. If you couldn't tell, we've got a movie to discuss. So let's discuss Hancock. Let's discuss Blumhouse and all of the brilliant minds behind this production in a little in a little place we call the Derry Public Library.
Mike Hanlon, if you see...
Excuse me, sir. Do you have Prince Albert in a can? You do? Well, you better let the poor guy out.
Mike Hanlon, did I have to go? Did I have to get cleaned up? Tell him I'll see him tonight.
Get out! Last chance, told you. Get out! Excuse me, ma'am.
All right. Well, in the Derry Public Library, as always, we discuss the production and crew of this film. So let me do a rundown. As I mentioned before, and I think at this point I've mentioned his name at least five times, this film, Mr. Harrigan's Phone, was directed and written by John Lee Hancock. The cinematography was by John Lee Hancock's right-hand man, John Schwartzman, no relation, I don't believe, to Jason Schwartzman, but John Schwartzman. He has also worked heavily with Paul Feig, who I joked about before, but he's actually got a pretty eclectic career. He's got an Oscar nomination for Seabiscuit, starring my favorite Spider-Man, Tobey Maguire. And he also worked on not only Colin Trevorrow's god-awful Jurassic World movies, but also The Book of Henry.
Starring Jade Martell.
Starring Jade Martell. And also Naomi Watts of I Heart Huckabee's fame. And he also has some King's Dominion because he worked alongside Rob Reiner. And not for Stand By Me or Misery, but for The Bucket List, which stars other King's Dominion veterans, Morgan Freeman and Jack Nicholson. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention the true highlight of John Schwartzman's career, which is Airheads, starring the whale star, Brendan Fraser. So, and I got to say, I love Airheads. You're a big Airheads fan, right, Randall?
Huge Airhead.
Love it. How about you, Jen? You like Airheads?
Love Airheads, yeah. Mm-hmm. Probably my favorite Brendan Fraser movie, I think.
Yeah, you know, it might be mine too, although I am kind of partial to School Ties, although they commit the cardinal sin by, I don't know, casting two people that are clearly not Jewish. Brendan Fraser and I believe, oh God, what's the guy's, his father.
Chris O'Donnell?
No, not Chris O'Donnell. That would be funny though if he was Jewish, because he couldn't be further from the truth on that one. I'm going to forget his name, but Ed Lauder, that's his name.
Oh, the great Ed Lauder.
You look at Ed Lauder and you're like,
Golden Years.
That is true. He's from Golden Years. And you look at him and if you think Jewish, you're crazy. So
we played Rabbi Heisenberg or whatever in Golden Years. I'm kidding.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he's just sitting there the whole time, just being like, "Oi, where's this shop at these days?" Anyway, so the music was by Guillermo del Toro's go-to composer Javier Navarrete, who we'll talk about a little bit soon. And then, like Firestarter this year, this is a Blumhouse production, and we're gonna get to them soon. And isn't that weird? Firestarter 2022. It happened. That happened.
It feels like a million years ago.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. I literally pulled from the old script for Firestarter 2022. And I just looked at some of the notes and I was like, wow, we really did that episode this year, 6 months ago. So how about that? Yeah. The runtime. Yeah. 106 minutes. Do we think this movie's too long or too short? Quick.
Too long.
Too long.
Yeah. A little too long. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. Well, guess what? The history of this is not too long, so there's not much history to discuss. I mean, If It Bleeds, it arrived in April 2020, right at the peak of the pandemic. We have two episodes dedicated to the collection in this main feed. Check them out. And then Netflix acquired the film rights to Mr. Harrigan's Phone 3 months later that July. And by that point, they had already announced that Blumhouse Productions would produce alongside Ryan Murphy, with Hancock directing. And then a year later, roughly October 2021, Donald Sutherland, Jade Martell, Kirby Howell, Baptiste, and Joe Tippett joined the cast. And the production went down in Connecticut, not in Atlanta, on October 20th.
Credit.
I know. That's pretty great. I got to say, kudos to them for going beyond, you know, the city of Atlanta. No shade to Atlanta. I like Atlanta. It's a good place. But they film everywhere there.
It doesn't look like New England.
It doesn't look like New England either. Although it does look like Indiana, because my boys in Stranger Things, the Duffer Brothers, they do a pretty good job of making it look like Indiana. Anyway, October 2021, it started production. It wrapped December 22nd, 2021. That is pretty efficient. That's why we are talking about this movie today. So let's talk about John Lee Hancock. I'll be honest, I actually like The Founder. I thought Saving Mr. Banks was okay. I think most of his movies I've seen are, I'll tag with the same adjective I'll tag here, prescriptive. I think it's nothing too flashy, gets the job done. And that's what I'd say about Mr. Harrigan's Phone. What are some takeaways from his direction here with this film? Are there any highlights?
He's very competent. I mean, that's the thing is I've seen a handful of his movies. The Founder is actually one I feel like that could have been such a better movie if it wasn't directed by Hancock. But that's not to say he's a bad filmmaker. Like, I've seen like a handful of his movies, including The Highwaymen. I went to the South by Southwest after party, which you guys have discussed on a previous episode. And I remember thinking it was fine, which is kind of how I feel about all of his movies. And so I can't say that I was particularly excited that he was adapting King. And I remember being confused at the time because you see Jason Blum's name, Blumhouse, you see Ryan Murphy, who, you know, Ryan Murphy is such a weird producer on this because he's such a throw everything at the wall, melodramatic kind of creator. And this is so not that, the story or Hancock's movies at all. And I'm just curious. I am genuinely curious, like, what brought Hancock to this material. And the thing is, I do think it has something to do with the coming of age aspects of it. Like, I mean, it's so weird. It's marketed as a horror movie, and we're going to talk more about that later, I'm sure. But like, that's the thing, was I was always like, well, the story's not that scary. John Lee Hancock does not direct horror. He does some crime movies. Like him and Costner go way back. Like him and like Costner's been in a bunch of his movies because Hancock wrote a bunch of stuff. And he wrote like Perfect World.
Perfect World. Which is actually not bad. Like,
yeah, it's a pretty good movie. Yeah. And like him and Costner's been in like a handful of his movies. And you know, hey, give him 10 more years, he might have been a good Mr. Harrigan. But but you know, I don't know. Like, I think that well, I guess this probably won't be scary. And then the trailer promised that it would be scary. And then it wasn't scary. And it's not only not scary, it's profoundly disinterested in being scary.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think that it's a confident film in a lot of ways in terms of, I think Hancock knows what he wants to say. I think he knew how to shoot it. I think he's reverent to the material. He's good with his actors. But it's not exciting, which is true for, I think, most of his movies.
Yeah, Jen, what do you make of the direction, and especially even just kind of the distancing from horror?
Well, I don't really know too much about John Hancock. I have seen The Blind Side, and I'm not going to say anything about that movie right now.
Yeah, it's not good.
Anything nice about it. But what I do really like about this movie is, I think competent is a great word for it. It just feels like it is solidly made. I love the fall atmosphere, and I love how kind of languid it is. You know, it just kind of feels like drifting through an autumn season. And yeah. I really like that. But like you were saying, it's not that exciting. You know, this would be a great like September background watch for me. And I could see myself putting this on over and over again when I've got stuff I need to do, but there's nothing that really draws me in, you know?
You know what this reminded me of? You know, dial the clock back to December when we talked about Hearts in Atlantis, and we were like, oh, they don't make movies like this anymore. It's like, well, they kind of hear they do, you know?
I will say 100% that was a bonus for me, is that I liked how it was a drama. But the thing was, it wasn't marketed as this. You know what I mean?
It wasn't.
It's like,
no.
And I think that it's almost sometimes hamstrung by the horror. It's a drama. This is a coming of age drama. But the thing is, it doesn't have a lot to hang its hat on. The premise is pretty thin. And then it has to sort of do these jump scare moments that don't quite work. It's such a strange little movie. So I appreciate that. I agree. I wrote languid too, Jen. That's a phrase that I wrote down. Mm-hmm. And I really kind of appreciate the sort of, you know, unhurried aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I still think it's too long, but that's only because I don't think there's quite enough to fill out the runtime. Mm-hmm. I like that he takes his time, but it's kind of like stretching a piece of gum so much that it loses its, you know, solidity, and you start to see all the holes in it, you know, because you stretch it too thin. That's kind of like how I see this, is that this is a story that doesn't demand like, what, 110 minutes or something? I feel like it 90, maybe it could have been better, but you know.
Yeah, I think if they chisel it down to 90, and I think might as well just talk about the fucking horror aspect of it. You know, I think that there is a horror movie here. I think they certainly lean away from it. And I think that the reason why it's perhaps, you know, it eschews a lot of the horror elements is because it certainly sinks its teeth into the actual source material. I mean, you want to talk about a dedicated adaptation. This is a very dedicated adaptation. I mean, this is, it's probably why King really liked it, you know, based on his tweet. And
It's his story, man.
Story through and through. Yeah. And I, you know, there's one aspect of it, you know, that you, I think really what you have to center it on is, you know, what's going on from, you know, beyond the grave. And now a lot of it could be that it's, you know, implied or inferred and stuff. But I think that there's a part of me reading the story, you hear about these incidents that happen, and Craig connects them to, you know, his pleas to Mr. Harrigan with the phone. And there's a part of you that gets to dream all that stuff up. And I wonder, you know, if you chisel this down to 90 minutes and you show those sequences and you lean in on the horror. And I have some ideas later on, especially as we get to casting. Mm-hmm. Is this a better movie, or does it absolutely fracture the sort of tone that you have? So is it kind of like a catch 22? Like, if you lean too much into the horror, do you lose what makes it sort of, I don't know, kind of feel cohesive in a way? Because this does feel like a cohesive film. It just doesn't feel as interesting as it could be. And I think mm-hmm. that if you lean a little bit more into the horror, it maybe could dazzle a little bit more. But I also worry that you lose something, because here's the thing. The minute you lead into the horror and you lean into the idea that Harrigan is this, you know, force from beyond the grave, it kind of derails any of the relationship that you have between Craig and Harrigan. And I think that's kind of the delicate balance that King, you know, weaves in with the book, because he leaves so much of it into up to your imagination. But on screen, you know, you can't just leave everything to your imagination, because, I mean, with here, it's this very like, oh, okay, we get the voiceover, we get some of the sort of the, you know, the music, which is doing a lot of the heavy lifting to bring some of the tension into the air. And I just wonder, what do you think? Do you think if we did see some of these incidences happen, it would, and we made it more of a horror movie, would we be talking about it differently? What do you think, Randall?
Yeah. Yeah, why not? I mean, it's like, it needs something. It needs spark. It needs, like, yeah. That's what it doesn't have. It doesn't have a lot of set pieces. Like, only, like, two things happen.
Yeah, you know, right?
I mean? It's like, or, like, I guess three. It's like, you know, Mr. Harrigan dies, the situation with the bully, and then the situation with the drunk driver. Mm-hmm. Those are the three things that happen. Nothing else really happens in this. And I think that's sort of the problem. And, but, you know, the biggest problem, and I think, is that, and this is, I think, I'm going to use the word competent a lot, because I think that's a good word for this. I think Jaden is competent. I think he's a very good young actor. I think Donald Sutherland is obviously Donald Sutherland. But I never saw the connection between them, really, except for the one scene when they were setting up his phone and they were allowed mm-hmm. to be a little playful together. Otherwise, the sort of funereal kind of tone, the kind of, you know, the which is matched so well by the score, which I think is really quite lovely. Mm-hmm. It doesn't, like... You're right. That has to do a lot of heavy lifting. The relationship is never quite there. So I never quite got on board with his obsession, not obsession, but I understand his fascination to some degree with Mr. Harrigan, but it's like, I see his fascination from an ideological standpoint, yeah. but not from a personal. I don't feel like they care about each other that much.
Like when he says, oh, I'm here by my own admission, you don't buy it.
Yeah, you know, it's like, Jaden does a nice job with that little monologue about the smell of the books and everything. Like, it's memorable, but I still don't really believe it. And, you know, like, I think a lot of young King characters in these latter days, Jaden's character is like a little old man in a teen's body. I mean, that's just kind of how King writes youth these days, which isn't bad. It's just, you know, it's it is what it is. But so I don't know. I mean, yeah, more stuff needs to happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think horror would have been a great, that's the thing, is I think a lot of the themes are already baked in, but I think that it's it still could have maintained a languid pace if it just maybe hit those horror moments a little harder. Yeah. Like, you know, you texted me, Mike, about like when Kenny dies, we never see him die. Like, no. We just see his body, and you're like, we should have seen it. And it's like, yeah, we should have seen it. We should have seen at least just like, I mean, I will say this though. The only reason that maybe we shouldn't have seen it is because I think Hancock is embracing ambiguity a lot more than King did. And we can talk more about that in a minute. But I think that Hancock really doesn't want this to be suit. It's like almost like Kubrick and The Shining, if you think about it that way, where it's like they really want there to be this suggestion that it is, none of it is supernatural. Mm. And I think that Hancock really leans into that here perhaps to the detriment of the story.
And also, like, what's the end game of that ambiguity? Like, does it really, like, does it serve, like, any the arc for Craig at all? Like, I think so.
And I actually have a lot of thoughts about that that I think are good. It still doesn't make it a great movie.
Yeah.
Because it's, right. like, it's not cinematic, right?
Like, well, extrapolate on that. I'm interested to hear your take on that. For me, it's, like, I could see it in some respect in terms of it adding some weight into his own coming of age and his arc, but especially with the idea that like phones demystify the world and whatnot. But I don't know, what's your take on this? Like,
I mean, demystifying the world is a good way to put it. I think, and I thought about this a lot because I was like, what is that purpose of that ambiguity? And a lot of it comes down to that scene where he talks to the preacher, the priest, and the priest says, have you, and I don't remember if this is in the story or not, Jen, maybe you remember, you have a better memory than me about this stuff, but it's like he basically says, I think it's time that you examine your relationship to your phone. Mm-hmm. And that to me is very much like Hancock's very heavy-handed filmmaker. I mean, like Highwaymen is the most, like, I don't think it's a bad movie, but that's a real, like, old man yells at cloud movie. It's like, actually, Bonnie and Clyde were bad, you know, and we shouldn't celebrate them. Like, it's very much that kind of movie. And this is very much like, hey, phones are bad.
Well, I was going to say, this is a very old man yell at cloud also.
I will say, credit to him, though, for showing that even though Harrigan gets the big monologue about how these phones are going to destroy the world. And I feel like that is taken directly from King's book, which
it tracks. It is. Yeah.
But Harrigan is also obsessed with this phone. Like, he's also looking at it while Craig is reading to him. So I give him credit for that because he's not acting like anybody is above this. It's really about how this has consumed our entire being. And like, I think one of the last lines is like, we're wedded to our phones. And I think that's a bad marriage. And that's very true. And this is very much, I think, like a boomer sort of like reckoning with the idea of how phones are shaping people's minds and the way we engage with the world, especially because they spent most of their lives not having them. And they're so taken with them. Like, when I say they, I mean like King, Hancock, Harrigan. They're so taken with them, but they're also like, what if I had this my whole life? You know, that probably would have been bad. And I feel that way as somebody who, you know, spent at least like a good chunk of my life not having access to the internet and a lot of other things. So I think what it really means for me is that phone, and this kind of ties into probably stuff I've talked about in the pod and stuff that just ties to the way I see the world. Phones make us narcissistic in the ways that lot of things in our modern culture do. Technology, you know, it inherently like silos us from the rest of the world. It makes us feel more connected, but we're more distant than ever. And the thing is, I think phones give us a sense of self-importance because suddenly, and this movie doesn't engage with social media, which I think is smart. It predates a lot of social media. So there's that too, you know, but it's like the thing about, let's put it this way, like the metaphor, right? When somebody's dead, you can't connect with them anymore, right? Like they're gone and you might pray to them. You might speak to them. You might go to their grave and talk to them, but you don't expect anything back. And I think sometimes like we need these places where we can shout into the void and nothing will come back to us because we say things we don't mean. And we say things when we're angry and we vent and we yell. And that's what God is for a lot of people. And, but we don't, I mean, unless you're really hyper-Christian, you don't really believe that what you say is going to come back. But the thing about phones is that we don't realize we're talking to people. We don't realize what we're doing is going out into the world, right? When we fire off a tweet, we don't think about how far it goes. And so when you put these things out into the world, now you're getting an instantaneous response to the things that you put out in the world. And you start to think that you are, and then that call and response, sort of the way that that's, you know, inculcated into you, is essentially it makes you feel as if everything you do has weight, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so it's like Craig becomes obsessed with, I think the reason is like Craig becomes obsessed with the death of Kenny because he feels like it was him that he did it. And then later he becomes obsessed with the death of the drunk driver because he thinks he did it. But there's a good chance it was just coincidence, you know? Mm-hmm. And like the movie leans into with the soap and everything and the way it ties to the teacher. It does. That's where the horror kind of stuff comes in. But I think it really, I think a lot about that precinct. Have you? And then the fact that Craig throws his phone in the water. I mean, I think both things can be true at the same time. Like the idea that this is supernatural, but these themes also resonate, which is that when you're young and you like we have to be careful when we have this connection to the larger world where all we have to do is hit a button and we are communicating with the entire world, like potentially, you know what I mean? And I think that there's a danger in that. And that's, I think, what King and Hancock are sort of warning people against with this is that, yeah, your stuff might have consequences, but also you might become obsessed with the idea of those consequences. And you might, it might consume you in the sense where that narcissism comes in where it's like everything is about me and yes. everything radiates from me.
Well, and I think that's the whole main character conundrum, right? That we have right now in our society, which is what ultimately a lot of your favorite movie this year, I feel, gets at, which is, you know, the World's Fair and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. We're all in the World's Fair. Yeah.
You know, we're, you know, and I think that's largely a big issue right now, with especially with teens and, you know, the youth, is just this idea that, and it's certainly something I had. I mean, it's almost because it ties into the Truman Show thing, you know, which they kind of itched at in the late 90s and certainly seems to be more exacerbated nowadays with social media and exactly what you've just been painting here, Randall, because it's a larger issue that I don't know if anyone's really wrestled with, the idea that, you know, there is an egotism that comes to it, a narcissism. And I do like this take, and I like this read, and I think it certainly it gives a little more depth to this movie that maybe isn't particularly owed it, but I do appreciate it's there, you know.
Let me say this, when you have to write like 800 words about a movie like this, you do have to think about it a little bit harder. And I think that's kind of where a lot of that stuff came from for me, was I was like, what do I say about this movie? Yeah. Like, yeah. And I think rewatching it, I did start to mine some of those themes. I don't know how much they were thought out beforehand. I think that with King specifically, I don't think he overthinks this stuff. I think he finds a good metaphor that speaks to something that he is, you know, grappling with himself. And then he's so good at, and you know, he said this and we've talked about it on the pod, is that he doesn't let theme guide him.
No.
He finds a story and an idea, and then the themes emerge naturally from that. And these are things that, you know, dovetail with the way I see the world. So I'm pulling all this stuff out of it. I don't know how conscious a lot of that was in this movie. So.
Well, the thing I always say about the old man yell at clouds thoughts is that I don't necessarily disagree all the time. It's mostly just the way it's delivered, right?
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Like, you know, like if you don't acknowledge the fact that you are privy to it, which this film does, is in the sense that, as you already outlined, with Harrigan actually embracing the phone in ways, and that we're all part and privy in, you know, to this, these quote unquote social sins. I think that, you know, in the long line, we could all agree with it. I think most of the time, because Twitter and social media, when these old man yell at clouds thoughts are put out there, we have such a knee jerk reaction that we don't get to really kind of sit with it and go, oh yeah, well, no, that does have a point. I agree. But what are we going to do about it? I mean, that's ultimately what it comes down to, is that, like, well, it's already here. This is it. This is what's going to be. So this is the norm. Jen, what are your thoughts on all this? I mean, what do you make of especially the sort of, I don't know, the commentary on the technology of it all, especially with phones?
I think everything y'all are saying. I think what I think is interesting about this is how this story is really equating phones with life, you know, because like when Mr. Harrigan gets this phone, he suddenly has a way to participate in life again, even from so far away. Like, he's semi-retired, but he is able to still operate in the business world. So the phone gives him life that he wouldn't have had otherwise. And then what I think the horror of this story comes from is the fear that this ability, like, now Craig has the ability to take life with this phone. If you see this as him actually causing these deaths, which I think I do, he's got this ability to over other people's lives just with like the tap of a few buttons. And so I think it's just like this awesome power that neither of them really understands what it's doing. And so the horror for me is that Craig, as I read the story, not necessarily as I watch the movie, but as I read the story, I find myself like sensing Craig being afraid that this power is going to consume him, that this power over other people, that this narcissism, like, I think he can feel it growing inside him. And I think he doesn't like it. Like, at the end, he talks about asking Mr. Harrigan to essentially kill people is hurting Mr. Harrigan, but I think he's really, that's a way of him understanding that it's hurting himself, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's all really interesting in the story. I just think that's an internal feeling that I don't think the movie quite captures. So like, if you were going to try to make this scary, like part of me would really love to see like a creepy Donald Sutherland in the background and like spooky.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Know? Yeah.
But then on the other hand,
Like you think a lot about the other versions of this
exactly.
movie that could exist, and that is one version that could exist, and it could be great. You know, right. I don't know though. I mean, the thing is, this is a perfectly competent version.
It
of
is.
This story.
It is.
And it's just there. Yeah. But there are so many like what ifs with this one. Like, I certainly don't think that. I think Hancock made the movie he wanted to make. I just think about what if Sam Raimi made this movie. I don't know. You know. So.
But I feel like this is going to sound like a dig on the movie, and I don't mean it to be, but it feels kind of cheap and kind of fast, like getting out there. And it could just be that we're used to like just seeing these productions stretch to 2-3 years. And so when a movie actually gets produced, it feels crazy to us. But like, there are really no effects in this movie.
No,
you know?
No.
And I worry that if they had put some ghosty effects in it, it would make it look a lot more cheap than it does, you know? Mm. Like, well, as of now, it can kind of just get by on some nice scenery and music and good acting, you know?
Well, I'm glad you talked about the fast turnaround, Jen, because that's a good segue into the next topic I want to discuss here, which is Blumhouse. Because, you know, big elephant in the room here, Blumhouse and Ryan Murphy. And I don't really know if I have much to say about Murphy, save for the fact that, you know, this is a guy that gets the job done. And I think that's pretty crucial and perhaps maybe even beneficial to the, you know, a quality to consider when it comes to King adaptations, seeing how, you know, most, if not all, spend their time in development hell, as we outlined back in August in our Halloween King. But I think that quality can also be attributed to Blumhouse and Jason Blum. I mean, I think these are pretty much Hollywood billionaires who clearly subscribe to the Bachman-Turner Overdrive motto of, quote, taking care of business. And so I guess my big question is, you know, do we like them being involved in King's Dominion? You know, now, like, because you think about it, Blumhouse, as I mentioned before, was responsible for Firestarter and this, and hell, even The Black Phone, which is, you know, King adjacent with Joe Hill.
I was going to say, like, have they done a good King adaptation yet?
Well, that's the thing. It's like, and I feel like they're attached to the boogeyman. I can't remember. I'd have to look back.
Oh,
at
I
it.
Think they are. Yeah. Because so, I think the host, I think Rob Savage like has a deal with them.
He does. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, on one end, I'm glad these guys are fast tracking these movies out. You know, it's kind of cool that we're starting to get this stuff. I mean, especially for us when we need to mix the content, you know, someone's got to make the donuts. Am I right? So, it, you know, in that sense, like, yeah, great. Awesome. Here's a week that we can talk about this as opposed to coming up with some, you know, going hit the ideation table. But on the other end, it's like what you're saying, Jen. It's like, you know, is the quick 180 good? I think for the most part, Blumhouse's track record, I think the more cynic could personally, you know, can certainly sit there and go, well, you know, maybe if they thought it out more, they'd, you know, it'd be more successful. But then you look at their successes and the fact that they banged them out very fast. I mean,
yeah, I like the model. Impressive. I think the nature of the model, though, is you're going to get more misses than hits.
Oh, 100%.
I think it's true for them, but they have such big hits. And they also, you know, they offer opportunities that are disappearing rapidly in our studio system. So overall, I'm a Blumhouse fan. I just don't like a lot of their movies. And I especially don't like, I mean, I don't know. Firestarter, I didn't hate. Like, I think that the vitriolic response to that movie was a little bit overwrought.
I agree.
It's not good. I don't really like remember it, but it's like, you know, it could have been a lot worse. But, you know, you want
isn't
more
that content,
King adaptations. Yeah.
But isn't that a content across the board now? It's like, it wasn't awful, but I don't remember it. Like, I feel like that's 99% of like the Disney like output.
It's so hard. It's so hard to, I don't know if I'm getting older, if just, you know, what it is, but I hear a lot of other people have this similar sentiment. And maybe a lot of it has to do with the idea that we are on our phones all the time and our brains are processing information so much quicker. But it's like, it's so rare that I really remember a movie these days.
I know.
Like, you know, and there are some I do, which gives me hope that I'm not just, you know, my brain's not just like falling to pieces, but you know, I just feel like these things just drift from my mind like lumps of crab, you know? Mm-hmm.
So. Jen, what do you make of Blumhouse? I mean, you cover horror day to day and in and out from multiple, you know, reputable publications. So where do you stand on Blumhouse? Are you in or are you out?
I'm in. I mean, I still, Firestarter didn't break my heart, but I still find myself wondering what might have been. But I don't know what else I would have wanted from this movie. Like, this movie, I'm fine with them pumping it out. Keep that model going and make a couple of these that are just kind of slight, just fun. Languid, I'll put them on. It's fine. It's not going to change my life. And then take your time with a movie like Firestarter and do the effects right and do it well and give me the movie that I want. But yeah, I mean, I don't really have a problem with the Blumhouse model. And I think it has given me, and I don't have a problem with the smaller horror movies. You know, like, I don't need every movie to change my life. I don't need every movie to, I don't need to remember it at the end of the year, but then, you know, it's not going to make my lists of movies I'll go back to. So I don't know.
I mean, I want more movies like these.
I agree.
Especially mm-hmm. ones that don't feel the need to like adhere to the algorithm like everything else does. And that's because that's really what kills me when I watch a lot of low budget horror or Blumhouse stuff is it just feels algorithmic.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like this doesn't. It
feels very old school.
It's just not exciting. And a movie can be languid and still be exciting. I mean, look at like Don't Look Now or something, you know, it's like, I think that this movie, there's not enough there.
Well, here's a question I wanted to pose. So when If It Bleeds came out, I feel like Hollywood just like gutted it in terms of like taking out like taking all of it instantly. So like, you know, you had Ben Stiller doing a Rat. Darren Aronofsky was going to produce Life of Chuck.
We thought If It Bleeds was going to be the second season of The Outsider.
Where in terms of your priorities or your rankings, Jen, for you, like given those projects and those that are attached to it, including, you know, Harrigan here, where, you know, what was your ranking there? Like, was Harrigan at the top?
Because I don't think so. I enjoyed Harrigan a lot, but again, it's like not the most exciting story in that collection either. Yeah. I think Rat is the one I'm most curious about, just because that's such a bizarre story, and to have Ben Stiller attached to it, just like, I want to see what that's going to be. Yeah, I can pretty much tell you what the Holly story would be. And Life of Chuck seems like a big risk. Like,
yeah, I agree.
That seems like a 30% chance that it's going to be amazing and 70% chance it's going to be a big old mess, you know?
Well, the fact that Aronofsky's would only be producing also puts me on pause, but because I actually, if he was attached to it and directing it, I could see him doing it. You know, it's very similar.
I've watched Pablo Larraín do it. I think that was
absolutely. But I say all this just because, you know, I remember when I was still covering the news beat at that point and all these were coming out, Harrigan was at the bottom for me. Like, I just didn't interest me. Like, because it was so, you know, King has some stories that are so, you know, one and done that, you know, upon reading it, I'm like, oh, okay. There's not really that many ways you could twist this to make it exciting beyond the page. Mm. And to have a literal adaptation here, I mean, it's not surprising to see a lot of our listeners in Discord who have already watched it be like, well, if you read it, you know, it's kind of shrug worthy. And they're not wrong, because, you know, if you read it, you know everything that's going to happen down to the T.
Yeah.
And but then again, there's not really that many ways to swerve unless you like really leaned in on this being like a ghost movie in a way. So I don't know. I just think like looking back at this, It's just still baffling to me that this is the one that got turned around that fast. Like, we're still waiting around for
now. I think it was just the right team, right? You know, it was just Blumhouse, Ryan Murphy, John Lee Hancock. These are all people who produce a lot of content, you know, and King, obviously.
But, and especially Murphy. I mean, Murphy, say what you will about him, but like, the guy never fucking stops, and neither does Blumhouse. Oh, yeah. So like, that's why I wanted to throw that out there and be like, do we want them more attached to King properties? Because at least we see them, right? You know, I mean, for me, it's like, I'm cool with it. I'm keep going for it, because I feel like we have hit or miss properties anyway with King. So if they're going to take them, at least we get them out there. You know, like, I mean, I know like Jane's trying to usher out fucking From a Buick Gate, But I think it's because he's independent that it's taken for fucking ever. I mean, I'm sure sure the pandemic didn't help, but like, I'm sure if, you know, Blumhouse grabbed or snatched the rights to Blue from A View to a Kill, we'd at least be halfway through the production at this point right now, you know? But
for better or worse, you know.
For better or worse. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Real quick, let's talk about the music, because we've talked about how we like Navarrete's score. I really thought this is like the stealth MVP of this movie. I think the piano is elegant. I love the scale. I think it does a lot of heavy lifting in terms of keeping the ominous and the tension at an even flow, particularly in the second half. What do you all make of the score, real quick? Are you similar thoughts?
Yeah, I was a fan of it. It didn't really stand, like, I'm trying to remember the theme in my head and I can't, you know? So it just kind of seamlessly blended in, but I did love experiencing this movie, you know? So yeah.
Very atmospheric. I think there's more interest in the indie rock of the era that was represented. Uh-huh.
Incredible transition, Randall, because I have them all listed here. So here are all the needle drops in this movie. And it's a mix, you know. You have Blessed Assurance by Fanny Cosby and Mrs. J.F. Knapp. You have Veni, Vidi, Vici, which is performed by the Black Lips.
Ja Rule.
Atlas, performed by Battles. Stand By Your Man, performed by Tammy Wynette. 2080, performed by Yesair, probably the only hit. Sailing.
No,
to
they
Bison.
Had a couple. They had a couple.
That was their big, big, big one, though, if I recall. Sailing to Byzantium.
Byzantium.
That was Liars.
Liars.
Cure Me by Radiate. Untitled Number 4 by Sigur Rós, taking it from Vanilla Sky, because I don't know if you've ever seen Vanilla Sky, but that song is the track from Sigur
Rós.
That's
a bold choice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Bubbly, it was a cover of a Kobe Kaye song by Daniel Lewis and Louise Schultz. Pass Me Not, O Gentle Savior, again, a Cosby and Doan song. Apocalypse Dreams by Tame Impala, who I love to death. Turn My Swag On by Soulja Boy, tell him.
All
right. I'm Your Boogeyman, performed by Casey and the Sunshine Band. White Lightning, performed by George Jones. And Be Thou My Vision by Traditional. Are we missing some? I feel like we're missing some big tracks in the late aughts and the early teens. I'm talking like Vampy Weeks. Like I want some Vampire Weekend. Like,
where's Animal Collective and all this?
Yeah, exactly. I was like wondering, like, it could have been like, you know, 2012 and then like, or 2010 and like My Girl starts playing or something like that.
This took me back. Yeah, the music was wild. But you know, not intrusive or anything. It was fine. Yeah.
It's just weird to hear some of this stuff being like period piece-esque.
Well, the thing is, no movies ever are set in this period. You know?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things I think is kind of cool about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like about 10 years too early for this time period. You know, because I remember it was the 80s and now we're into nostalgia 90s, you know, and this just is, you know. I don't know.
Ready for 2006 or 7, yeah.
Right,
You could thank Ariana Grande for, you know, bringing all the early aughts fucking nostalgia, because everyone's really excited for that period, you know. Well, considering 9/11 happened, I wouldn't get too fucking stoked for being nostalgic for that era. As someone who lived it, was in the front lines, 99 to 2002 sucked, so, you know, either way.
Some rough years, We did get Final Destination, though, so.
Did get Final Destination a year before 9/11, so that was good. But I was thinking about that the other night when I was watching it. But I love Devin Sawa. Sawa was in this? Do you think Devin Sawa would have been good?
Ooh,
Devin Sawa as Mr. Harrigan?
I'd be more interested.
Or Craig.
I don't know about Mr.
Current
Harrigan.
Day Devin
current
Sawa
day Devin Sawa.
Current like day Devin Sawa.
Like a 17-year-old or whatever.
No. Yeah. He needs to play Craig's dad.
Oh, that would be good. That'd be good. Well, let's actually talk about Craig's dad in a section we call Heroes and Villains.
I'm going to have to kill this fucking clown. Welcome to the Losers Club, asshole!
All right, well, we're going to be talking to Jaden later in this episode.
He sucks.
Yeah, right. He's awful in this. No. I think he's really effective as a teen. This is probably his last time to do that. I feel like he's going to be a little too late to this point. I feel like now he's got to play like college students at this point. Like, I don't know if he can pull off the high school thing anymore.
They can digitally de-age him, you know.
They could. I have a de-aging question very soon. But I don't know. For me, watching Martell in this, I couldn't help but like get the sense that he's morphing into Daniel Radcliffe before our eyes. Like he just looks like Daniel Radcliffe. He kind of has the vibe of Daniel Radcliffe. Although like
weird, like Radcliffe.
I know. Yeah. I wish he could. I think he might. He's got a pretty eclectic resume. What do we make of his turn here? And is it distinguished enough from his own Bill Dembro? Because I saw a lot of Bill Dembro in here too.
Yeah.
I got to be honest, Mike. I have nothing to say about any of these characters except for competent. Aside from the bully, I'll be able to talk about him.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I've got some thoughts about the bully.
So you can skip me for everything. My answer is competent.
Competent, okay. Yeah. I thought he was fine in this. I liked him a lot. I think other than it, the only thing I've seen him in is Knives Out. I enjoyed
Ryan Johnson masterpiece, according to Twitter.
That's right.
Can't wait for Glass Onion for the hyperbole.
This course is going to be so annoying. I'll probably enjoy it, but man, these people are annoying.
I got about 6 bottles of Robitussin to get me through it. So
you mean Moxie?
It's going to be a lot. It's going to be a great fucking fall. Everyone's sitting there being like, you know, Kate Hudson, that's a mood. can't wait. It's going to be wonderful. Anyway, Jen, sorry, I didn't.
No, that's okay. No, I thought he was great in this. I think there's not like he's really just kind of playing an every teen, you know. So there's not really a whole lot of like characterization to do. But I think he feels like he's just playing a regular kid, and I liked it. You know,
I will say, wasn't plugged into this movie until he comes in. I thought the kid in the beginning when he's hanging out there. First off, Hancock's direction doesn't really kick in at that point. It feels very like just point and shoot. Mm-hmm. Which I guess you could make the argument for the most of the movie. But I feel like in that section with the kid, I mean, I told Randall, I turned it off 5 minutes in because I was like, what the fuck is this? This is like cheap as hell. But when Martell comes in, I think he exudes some sort of agency that gives me a little bit more, that gives a little more weight. I just think he's interesting to watch. Like, I just think he's a compelling lead in that sense. Just watching him. So I think that he's a good conduit for the story. I think that it works. But I would be lying if I didn't think of like, oh, there's a lot of Bill Dembro here. Next up, Donald Sutherland, Mr. Harrigan himself. I mean, he's fine here. He gets like, what, 5 minutes? I think instead of talking about his performance here, which we can talk a little bit about, let's list off some of our favorite Donald performances. Randall, you mentioned one of my favorites, Don't Look Now. Incredible in that.
Body Snatchers, obviously.
Body Snatchers is wonderful. What else do you love him in?
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I love him in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's great in Buffy.
He's got great genes, too. Big fan of The Lost Boys.
Yeah, with his son. Yeah. Randall's favorite bad boy, Ace Merrill.
Flatliners.
Mm-hmm. Love Kiefer.
Yeah. Did you ever see him in 2004 Salem's Lot? I haven't seen him yet. Is he any
that's
good?
Right. Who's he? Is he Straker?
Or is he Barlow? He's
the Callahan, businessman isn't one. He? No, Callahan is the tall guy from...
Oh, James Cromwell?
James Cromwell.
He plays Straker. He plays
Straker, yeah. Because Rutger Hauer is Barlow, that's right.
Yeah,
I thought he was good in that, too.
Yeah, I mean, he's always dependable. That's the thing. And you might say, Randall, starts with a C.
Oh, he's competent.
Exactly.
I liked him when he voiced Dr. Sid in Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within.
Oh, I remember that. Did you go to that? Did you go to that opening weekend?
No, I lived in a small town and we didn't have it available. I rented it. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember going to that and being like, where are the chocobos?
It was not very good.
Not very good.
He's in Disclosure. You want to get fucked?
You want to get fucked? Is he really?
Yeah. Oh,
interesting. I love Sutherland. I'm always, you know, there are a lot of misses in Sutherland's resume, but he's never really the miss. I always feel like he's reliable. He's dependable. He's, what's the word again I'm looking for?
Competent. You know, he's greater than competent in JFK when he plays. Yeah. He has that huge fucking monologue. That shit's
steals
so
the
good.
Show. Steals the show. I sometimes go to YouTube and just watch that over and over
it's
again.
It's so good. I love that movie.
Here's a question, though. Does the movie work if we de-age Donald and have him play Craig, though?
Good God, why would you ask that? That is a horrible question. What if we de-age Kiefer and then like a father and son?
What if we aged son, up cool. Jaden and had him play Mr. Harrigan and aged down Sutherland?
It could be like a cool Craig. It could be a cool adaptation, you know.
It's a commentary on technology and its hold over us.
I'm all for it, Jen. I think it makes this movie that much more interesting. So we talked a little bit about, and you certainly hinted at it, Jen. about the idea of Sutherland being this more phantom force.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of want to see that version. I want to see a scene where, you know, our bully Kenny is being stalked throughout his house with like a sort of like shadowy Sutherland, maybe with like red eyes. I'm thinking Janos from Ghostbusters 2.
Yes.
With the fucking eyes and he's leaving Dana's uh-huh. apartment. I think that, I don't know. I just think that's a more effective movie, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But it also completely fractures the ambiguity that we were talking about, because at that point you're like, oh no, these are really fucking happening, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe they could like a cut where you could like switch between them, you know?
Uh-huh. The monster cut and the drama cut.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Any other thoughts on Sutherland?
Competent.
Yeah, that was fine.
Competent.
He was
okay.
competent.
Yeah. Yeah. So the other three are supporting cast. We'll go real quick. Kirby Howell Baptiste as Mrs. Hart. I got to say, I don't really feel anything for this death, because I just feel like this is kind of another chapter in the story. I mean, I know we get that nice moment between Craig and her and in the classroom where they're talking about Emerson, but it just feels so like prescriptive in terms of the emotionalism of it all. It's just very like, this is how you're supposed to feel, like, you know, projecting a lot of the sort of or at least forecasting her death. I just don't feel the weight of it all. But Jen, you seem like you could be arguing differently.
No, I liked her in this. I thought it was fine. I don't necessarily love what they did with the role, because I think in the story he has a crush on her at the beginning when he's like young, and then he pretty quickly moves on. And I feel like the way it was cast in this movie, there was this weird like kind of romantic tension between them.
I got that vibe
too.
Scenes.
And I was like,
thought was weird.
I don't know why that. And I think partly is because when you can't hear his internal monologue, you can't pick up on that relationship, that they tried to bring it into the dialogue, and it just didn't quite work, you know.
Well,
but I thought she was fine in it.
I got the director's cut, actually.
Oh yeah,
there's a scene where they're like, oh, the soap.
Ooh.
They're like, oh, let's meet up at Castle Rock. I am going to fucking smash. No, it doesn't happen. Thank God. Joe Tippett, no relation to Phil Tippett, I don't believe, but Craig's father. I know him from Mayor of Easttown. Thought he was pretty great.
Oh,
in that.
Yeah, uh huh.
You can tell.
Trying to figure out where I knew him from. That's it.
I feel like maybe this was filmed. This is probably filmed like in the aftermath. Obviously, it was in the aftermath of Mayor of Easttown. And I'm sure he was just like, hey, I did fucking great in that. I'm going to stretch my role here. And mm-hmm. it just felt like he's trying to do as much as he can with, I don't know, the little slices of life. He was just basically like, he was like the oracle at home. Like, oh, well, do you like the cell phone? Oh, I told you. You know, it's like little asides that he has. I mean, he does fine with it, but kind of a thankless role. Nothing really there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he's like an every dad, you know?
Yeah.
He's fine.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then let's get to the main event here, because we got a bully, which you know what that means. It means
power hour.
Randall, where does Cyrus Arnold rank as Kenny Yankovic for you in terms of the King's Dominion on-screen bullies?
I mean, definitely not one of the greater bullies, because he doesn't really get a chance to do much.
I know.
Like, he's just kind of an asshole. Yeah. I mean, he beats him up a little bit, I guess, but it's, you know, what I like about the performance is, and I won't go too long, it just, I like the performance of the bully. I think on paper, it's a pretty flat character, but I think this actor actually brings like a weird parasitic quality. Like, that's kind of how I just, like, he feels less malicious than kind of unstable. And because he gets like really emotional, like I can't tell how much of it is an act and how much of it isn't, which I kind of like. But when he's like, why did you have to tell on me? Why did you have to do that? You know, like, I love that. Like, that kind of like where it's he's an asshole, but he's also this like, I don't know, leech, you know,
yeah.
He's like draining your emotions and everything. And I knew a lot of bullies like that, like where. Like, I remember this one bully who was really nasty to me. He would always, like, knock my lunch out of my hands. And then one day he, like, pulled me aside, like, in the courtyard at school. And he's like, you know, I'm just messing around, right? You know, I'm just messing around. And I was like,
yeah.
And I was like, yeah. And he's like, you're not going to tell on me or anything, are you? And I was like, no. Because I thought he would leave me alone. And then he started bullying me again the next day. But he was, like, almost, like, really emotional and weird. And, like, it just reminded me of that. So I thought it was effective. Like, he wasn't, like, Bowers or anything where it's, like, this is like a sociopath, you know? He was like this guy who is, you know, unbalanced, and yeah. that person can almost feel a little bit more dangerous sometimes. So yeah, that's my thoughts. I just thought it was an actor doing well with a really small part.
I agree, which is a lot of the, you know, seems to be the case with a lot of the cast here in this movie.
And he's a distinctive look too, like yeah. he's got, you know, this big hair, he's a big guy, like he didn't look like, you know, you think it'd be a jock or something, but I mean, I'm pretty sure that's how King writes him too, but it's nice to see a different kind of bully sometimes.
Honestly, a realistic bully, because not all bullies are babes, as they tend to be in our you know, when you think about Ace Merrill and I mean, even like Henry Bowers in the first it chapter one, he's a good looking kid. You
know, he's a little young hunk in this, yeah. in the new one too.
This guy is
like they make him a little dirty, but look at his arms. Like this, I know, works out.
Yeah, seriously, Jen.
I shouldn't talk about children.
I know.
Like
I was just thinking that. Yeah, this is a problematic episode already, but it's okay. Jen talks about Robbie from Cobra Kai.
Oh, that's true. Hey, he is over 18. We're okay.
Yeah. Where was he in season one? Was he? You know, I'm just joking.
I didn't like it
just
until
joking.
Season three for sure. I don't know. I had a lot of issues with this bully as I was watching it. But I think you're right. I think it is a good performance, and I think he feels really relatable. And the way I kind of feel about this bully is the same way I feel about watching Kathy Bates play Annie Wilkes. Like, there is something in me that really wants to pity her and wants to, like, empathize with her. And that's terrifying, because she is really – she's an awful person, and she does really terrifying things. And I feel like this bully is trying to get me to, like – sympathize with him, because he feels really pathetic in a lot of ways, you know.
Yeah, that's what I dug about it. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. But it makes me really uncomfortable, you know, because I know that he's gonna die. I feel like I don't know, I think it makes it more tragic too, because he's not just a straight asshole, you know. You really feel like he's got some addiction issues, and he needs something that he's not getting, and he's compensating for that with bullying other people. And I feel like, I don't know, Craig kind of gets it, but it's just this emotional layer that I don't think I'm quite ready for in this movie, you know, because it's a lot.
It doesn't add up a lot, you know.
Yeah, I think the way I saw it was, you know, Craig has that scene where he's like, I hadn't thought about him as a real person before, you know, like where he's like, when he sees his family mourning, and right. I guess that relates to those themes I was thinking about, like, you know,
being online,
we throw things out into the ether without thinking about who's on the other end,
right?
And you know, like, he wishes that this kid would leave him alone, you know, he wishes this kid would be dead, and then it's like actually coming to see who it is that's on the other end of your wish, you know. And that's, you know, it's a small little moment that I think worked, you know, well enough for me.
So, well, you mentioned pitying him. I certainly pity him, because Cyrus Arnold, you know, his debut was he was the baby in or he was at least the son.
Oh, he was young.
Of Derek
Zoolander,
in Zoolander 2, and that movie sucks.
Wow. I never saw that movie.
Well, you might want to call. I pressed to describe Zoolander 2. I'd call it a nightmare, and certainly not a dreamscape.
If you think your dreams are disturbing, imagine the nightmares of Stephen King.
What are you, some sort of a horror movie guy?
Nope, Clyde, I'm a literary guy.
All right, speed round here. Our next section, we're going to be talking about what we loved and what we maybe not hated, but maybe one of our grievances. So for me, I'll go first. What I loved, the commitment to the prose. This is a page-to-screen adaptation, and, you know, look, sometimes it works, like in Pet Sematary, and sometimes it doesn't. In this case, it's sometimes it doesn't, you know, as we talked about with the Coda and Gerald's Game. Don't like that. I think you could have avoided that. I think this is kind of the middle ground there, where it's like, well, I appreciate the fact that it's a direct translation, but also would appreciate it as were. So that's why I loved and also kind of hated, you know. So anyway, Randall, love and hate. What do you?
I loved the setting. I loved that it was shot in Connecticut. That we saw the mountains, we saw the leaves, we saw the trees. Like, it felt very New England, and I like that. What I hated was it's a like, well, I didn't hate it necessarily. It's almost like adorable. Like it's this boomer vision of kids with cell phones. Like the idea that they're all cordoned off by like the brands that they use, like the rich kids or whatever have iPhones. And then there's like Androids and everything. It's just a very kind of like kids these days kind of vision of the whole thing. I didn't hate it. Like it was almost kind of charming. The what I did hate, though, is like when he texted the girl he has a crush on, he's like cool sweater, and she's like thanks, and like, but then they're like standing next to each other and they're still texting that to each other. It's like come on mm-hmm.
It's never kids gotten
still,
that bad.
Kids still talk to each other. Yeah, I mean, come on.
Yeah, I say that, but I, you know, who the fuck knows these days, especially you know, in the era of COVID, am I right? You know, who might as well be texting, right? So Jen, love, what is your love and hate?
I don't know. I think one of the things I thought was a nice little touch was when he fell off the roof and he was in the same position as he was when he beat him up. It was a weird position, but I thought that was just an interesting, subtle little touch that this is connected, you know? I don't really have anything that I really hated. I guess maybe the weird romantic tension between that I was mentioning earlier between the teacher and him. I did kind of enjoy the Dusty Bilodeau story because that's not in, it's only really alluded to in the book. So that was something that I thought was interesting, you know, one of the few deviations from the text.
Yeah. Well,
I also liked the book quotes from the quotes that he was reading from the other books, like they shoot horses, don't they? You know?
Yeah. Well, he certainly didn't do a quote from Pet Sematary, because that would be a little too confusing considering that we're in King's Dominion. But let's go there nonetheless. Our next section, The Cemetery.
What's the bottom of the truth?
Well, sometimes that is better. The person you put up there ain't the person that comes back. It may look like that person, but it ain't that person. Because whatever lives in the ground beyond the Pet Sematary ain't human at all.
That was a hell of a pretzeled seg. That's what we call like a pretzeled seg, and I don't have enough mustard to cover it up. But here's this section. We basically talk about what scared us. I got to say, I am stretching here. The only thing I could really say that kind of got under my skin is, and I knew it was going to happen early on, was the use of Stand By Your Man. I think that I love a good needle drop that way. You know, we talk about the Carpenters with 1408 a couple months ago. I thought this was really good. The minute that they set the ringtone, you knew that it was going to come back. I thought the scene where Craig is at the grave and you kind of hears it, and it's still, you can make the argument that it's in his head, still works. My big thing whenever we watch these paranormal shows is like, what if that did happen? You know, like what if you call out and it did respond? You know, multiple times in this movie, he talks about, oh, knock on the wall, or, you know, give me a text, or yada, yada, yada. But hearing that needle drop when you have it, it does kind of confirm that fear that you have. Like, what if it did happen?
Yeah.
And so for me, that was effective. But again, I am stretching. I'm like overstretching. Yeah. My muscle is being torn apart right now, stretching for that. Randall, what scared you?
Same moment. I thought the only moment that I thought was even remotely creepy was when he was standing at the grave and he called the phone and then put his ear to the ground and could hear it distantly through the dirt. That to me is really creepy. I think just for the nature of it just makes me think about like so close but so far, right? Mm-hmm. It's like this person that you knew very intimately is gone forever and they're dead, mm-hmm. but you're at their grave and their body is literally like a few feet from you. Yeah. And the ringtone, the fact that he can hear it through all the dirt, it's a great manifestation and a great sort of demonstration, I think, of that idea of that like connection between what you can't see and then like you. And that was very effective to me in that I thought it was a very potent metaphor, but also just creepy. Like if I heard that, it would very much freak me out.
I'd probably pee my pants, and then I'd be like, well,
I'd probably
go
shit
home.
My pants.
Well, both of them would be go home stains. You know, Jen, other than the needle drop and, you know, I don't know, spilling fecal matter in your pants. Like, what scared you of this movie?
I mean, nothing really. I will say it is like the rare kind of elevation from the text, because it's one thing to read about Stand By Your Man,
yeah,
and another thing to hear it. It's just the perfect song for that. The moment that scared me with that is when he finds the body and he kind of leans over and it starts playing. It's just kind of a cheap jump scare, but it just, I feel like, heightens the tension of that moment of finding a dead body. And, you know, you're a kid and you're like, oh, I don't know what to do with this, you know?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, other than like, it's just not really a scary movie, you know?
I know. Well, I'm hearing another ringing, and it's not the bells. It's the twinkle. It's the twinkle that calls us to King's Dominion.
There's another world out there.
I know there is.
Okay. Well, in King's Dominion, we talk about the other connections to King's work. There's not much here. I mean, the town is Harlow. It's been featured in multiple, you know, stories in King's Dominion. I thought that the fact that Harrigan loves country western, which is basically from the source material anyway, that screams King. We know that King loves country western. Anything else? Do you see like Jack Torrance in the background, or, you know?
Yeah, I mean, other than thematic, like, I feel like because we just talked about Fairy Tale, like, it just feels like
the
prototype for Fairy Tale, which also kind of, it's got like elements of Christine too, because I feel like all three of those kind of feel connected, you know?
What would you be opposed if like Craig had a It Chapter One poster on the wall? Or maybe
like
even chapter
photoshopped
two.
Somebody else in there.
Yeah, like,
yeah, they put like a different face on Bill.
Yeah, like it's like I don't know, like Shia LaBeouf from Holes.
No, it'd be like Will from Stranger Things or something. Yeah, yeah.
Well, like, you know, because, you know, remember the character posters for It Chapter Two that had like the adult and then the kid.
Yeah,
you know, you had the one there, and it's just like, you know, anyway. Good
bit. They could just digitally de-age Donald Sutherland to play him in the It Chapter One poster.
Oh, that would have been cool. Yeah. It just would have been a fun, cheeky nod. I'm sure Jaden Martell would have been like, let's cut the shit out. You know, take this fucking off the wall. Yeah, that's it. I mean, it really is. It's a bummer that we didn't get the Cujo, didn't pop up. And
yeah, I would have loved Cujo in this.
You know, would have been
cool. What if he like looked at his phone and he was like, show me, and that's what ended up killing everyone? Like, used the face activation?
Or like Comfior, like, you know, showed up in this. Or is that
Linoche comes back.
Comes back, you know.
Kill the bullies and I'll go away.
I'm trying to think of like the most natural King's Dominion you could have had here. I mean, really, you'd have to go back to like the Harlow stuff. I wonder, you know, the town accoutrements in the beginning, is that from King's, you know, are those from other stories? I don't know. I'm not familiar with enough with the Harlow, I guess.
I know he's mentioned Harlow. Harlow is part of the world, you know.
Yeah.
What if it's like the rebuilt school that Carrie burned down?
Oh, that could have been cool.
Or like Miss Desjardins like has come back to teaching or something.
Or like, what if it was like, you know, one of them mentioned like, hey, a lot of weird things happen around here. Did you hear about that fucking dome that fell on Chester's Mills? You know?
What if that causes the car wreck? He just like slams into the dome.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Just ridiculous.
I want you to kill this dome. Maybe that's what happens at the end of Under the Dome.
Ends,
we don't know. You know?
The dome ends.
You're like, hey, I got
that's
no
really
cell phone reception
conflict.
Under this dome. Well, anyway.
Yeah.
I guess it's time to give our final thoughts.
Dad, can we go now?
You ready?
Yeah, we've been ready for an hour.
Okay, I'll be right there.
You said that a half hour ago.
Yeah, my dad's weird. He gets like that when he's writing.
Randall, kick it off.
Competent, 2.5.
That's it. Oh, wow.
That's it.
Wow. Well, you could read, where can they read your full review, though?
It's on Fox, like basically Fox, like not, I don't know. Like it's like a Fox affiliate. Like it's all the local stations. My friend is an editor there. So she asked me if I wanted to do it. So
former Losers Club member, right?
Yeah. Allison Shoemaker.
So. Yeah. Oh. How about that? LC Dominion.
So yeah, just if you Google, I assume if you Google Mr. Harrigan's phone and my name or Fox, you'll find my review. I think it's a pretty good review. So
I'll link it I guess in the blurb that we have, I don't know. It's hard to do because if you're on Apple Podcasts, they don't allow links.
Yeah, like, I think I succinctly say what I said in long rambling sentences on this podcast.
Well, hey, there you go. Jen, what about you?
I'm going to give deserved a 3. I think I enjoyed it. I like it, like I think about this like Teen Wolf. Like it's just this perfect fall ambiance movie for me.
Teen Wolf?
Teen Wolf, yes.
Of all the comparisons, I would not have picked Teen Wolf.
Just but because of the fall feeling, you know? Not because of the werewolves and the basketball. There's, you know.
Michael J. Fox would have been good in this when he was younger.
Oh, yeah. That would have been fun. That would have given us a little flair.
Who's your favorite Teen Wolf, though? Is it is it Michael J. Fox? Is it Jason Bateman? Or who's is it
the hot guy?
Hillary
the guy
Swank,
from
right?
Curb Your Enthusiasm, Hillary Swank.
Sorry, that was the Teen Wolf. The next.
Oh generation. Yes, yes.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay, but are you asking me who is my favorite Teen Wolf as the Teen Wolf, or who is my favorite Teen Wolf continuing in his career? Because I think my favorite Teen Wolf as Teen Wolf is Michael J. Fox, but I prefer Jason Bateman.
Oh, interesting.
Is
wow.
For longevity, you know. So yeah.
Well, I guess I'd echo those thoughts. But anyway, so what was your closet?
My clown. No. I mean, it's hard not to talk about Teen Wolf, you know. At 3, I enjoyed it a lot. I'm going to probably put it back on, but I'm probably not going to remember too much about it and not pay attention to it, but it's a great fall background movie for me.
Do you like this movie more or less than I'll do the Netflix run for you. We already know that you love Gerald's Game more than this. I would be surprised if you're like, oh, I'm actually Harrigan's fan.
right. This is now my favorite adaptation.
Is this better or worse than In the Tall Grass?
Oh, better.
I agree.
No baby eating in this one. So
what about you, Randall? You haven't seen it.
Never
saw
Tall Grass.
All right. Well, no comment.
Well, they eat
you.
A baby.
That I said, don't let that dog go in the grass, and the dog went in the grass.
And
so
he
I'm
went
not watching
woof
it.
Woof. Right. Bye bye. 1922. Better or worse?
Worse.
Yeah, but more. Yeah, but more enjoyable, I think.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Oh, yeah,
1922 is a pretty miserable movie.
Yeah, it is a dark watch, movie. But I think it is a better movie.
It is a better movie.
You'd probably be more likely to rewatch this than the 1922.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. That's fair. I don't know if I can go there because I love my boy Thomas Jane, even when he's a homicidal killer. I guess he's not homicidal. He just kills his wife. That's not
homicidal. He's just not a serial killer.
He's singularly. He's not like Jeffrey Dahmer, also on Netflix.
That's right. Also Ryan Murphy.
What if Evan Peters was in this movie? You think that we'd like this movie more?
Is the bully? Yeah.
As the bully, he's Dahmer.
As Jeffrey Dahmer.
As Jeffrey Dahmer. Like, he dies,
but
then
he comes back.
Then Mr. Harrigan is now the hero of the story, you know?
The Murphy's Dominion. All right, I'll give my thoughts. I think, like you're saying, competent. This is completely serviceable. I think that's the best way to describe this movie.
Yeah.
And honestly, that's kind of how you could pretty much argue for any one of Hancock's works. I kind of do appreciate, though, how it doesn't get too treacly. As this past work does. Like, I mean, this movie really could have gotten like too saccharine or too sentimental. And I think that he staves off doing that. I mean, he doesn't really go that far into it, which is great. I think that constant readers can appreciate the commitment to the prose, as I've hammered all throughout this episode, but as I've also seen and said on this episode, most of them are already shrugging and saying, what's the fucking point? So for me, you know, if you read the story, sure. You want to see it come to life. Awesome. Here it is. If you haven't, hey, maybe it's a fun watch for you in the afternoon. A spooky watch for a spooky time like October. That's about it for me. I do think it is kind of baffling, as I said earlier, that this is the one that we got the quick turnaround to. No Duma Key, no revival. No Buickgate, but hey, Harrigan, the movie nobody was waiting for, which is, I don't know, there's something sad about that, but as another Netflix joint said in 2019, it's what it is. So for me, 2.5 bright red Pennywise clown noses with maybe a little book from Harrigan's own private library for added measure, the effort. Anyway, I think that's what.
2.75, I think. Maybe 2.6.
That's not bad. It's not bad.
Yeah. I think it's good. Service. It's competent, you know.
Yeah, competent. Well, I'm gonna competently put the final nail in this coffin. Before we go though, let's do some plugs. Jen, what do you have going on down at Psychoanalysis in October?
Well, our October theme is childhood fears, and we are talking about It Chapter 1 and It Chapter 2.
Oh, starring Jaden Martell.
Jaden Martell, exactly. Yeah. So that's been really fun. And then we just, I'm bummed I had to miss this one because we were in Maine, but Kyle, our fearless, I know. Oh, yeah. It was the worst. I know. But I did miss recording with Kyle, the Losers Club editor, on our episode with for Shaun of the Dead. But our Halloween episode is going to be with John from Creepy, and we're going to talk about Hell House.
Oh,
LLC.
Really? Are you?
Yeah.
John Grills? Mm-hmm. Holy
yeah.
shit.
Yeah. I know. Wow. I'm really excited and I That's love amazing. That movie. So,
very, very cool. Randall, what books or book should our listeners be reading right now?
We're in the Dark Tower, final stages. So, Wolves of the Cal is October, Song of Susanna, November, Dark Tower, December. And then, otherwise, this month we've got a fun interview with Chapo Trap House's Matt Crispin about The Dark Tower. He's a big fan and he has a lot of thoughts. It's a great interview. And then we're doing a Lobstrosities on Children of the Corn 4. I don't remember the subtitle. What is it?
I don't remember either, but I know
it's
Naomi
not the final
Watts
sacrifice?
Is in it.
It's been a few. Yeah. It's been a couple. I feel like it's been like a couple years since we did Urban Harvest.
I think it's been 3 years since
we've
done it. Yeah.
So yeah, we're back in Cornland in Lobstrosity, so that'll be really fun. And then what's the other one we're doing, Mike?
Oh God.
The Simpsons.
The Simpsons.
Oh yeah,
The Simpsons. That wasn't even on the calendar, but because initially, how everything is nowadays, they're all so fucking mysterious with their release dates. You can't just release them on the normal time. We didn't find out until this week. I thought it was October 30th that The Simpsons was going to do their Pennywise parody. But no, it's going to be October 23rd, which means that, guess what? You get a bonus. Sound like Jaden Martell's Bill Denver over here.
Oh,
you get a bonus episode this month. And so that'll be fun. We're going to talk all about Stephen King in Springfield, a.k.a. The Simpsons. So that'll be a good one. And I'm trying to rack my brain. What else? And then Wolves of the Cow is going to be the book episode at the end of the month. It's going to be a Halloween weekend extravaganza.
And there's more. We're just forgetting.
Yeah, so. We're just forgetting. Yeah. We're fucking tired. We just came back from Maine.
We just got back from
We're
Maine.
Talking about this movie. We're sleepy. But don't you be sleepy. Because as I mentioned earlier, we've got a 20-minute chat with Jaden Martell. He's going to share his thoughts on King. He's going to share his thoughts on technology. And we even detour into music a little bit. So stick around. Listen to that. And we'll see you next week over long days.
And pleasant nights.
Hi, this is Mike Rothman from The Losers Club. Thank you so much for doing this.
How's it going?
You know, I've just been counting, and this is your third Stephen King movie. I don't think I'm alone in noticing a trend. Is this pure happenstance, or are you chasing the King adaptations?
He's chasing me. I'm just kidding. No,
yeah.
That's totally a coincidence. Now I'm obviously a huge fan of his, but I think I'm just very lucky that it turns out that I'm part of the stories that he writes.
Well, what's your relationship to his work? I mean, especially growing up, were you a constant reader, in your teens, how familiar were you before even getting into like It Chapter 1?
Not very familiar. I mean, I grew up watching the adaptations of his work, but never really read. I mean, I did it when I was 13, so like I can't. Wasn't really reading The Shining at 12.
Yeah, it's a hard, tough one. Yeah.
But now I mean, I have a great respect for the work that he does.
Well, like, in both stories that you're working with in here, be it Ed or Mr. Harrigan's Phone, you're dealing with the way that he sees youth, right? Like the way that he portrays youth in stories. And what do you think are some strengths of, his storytelling when it comes to capturing youth, having been two of his big characters? I mean, Bill Denbrough being one of the biggest characters he's had in that capacity, but then, also Mr. Harrigan's Phone, he's tapping even into some more modern youth. Like, yeah. What are some qualities that you feel he really captures well on page?
Well, I think he creates this a feeling of nostalgia, despite, I didn't grow up in the 80s. I was a little bit around for the era that Mr. Harrigan takes place in, but I wasn't that age. But still, when I read his work, I feel attached to it. It always feels very personal. And he's not he's not afraid to relate it to himself. I think people write what they know, and, mm-hmm. and he does that. I mean, he comes up with these brilliant ideas and somehow creates these universes that I can't even imagine creating. But beyond that, he makes very human stories. And I feel like anyone can relate to his work.
That makes Absolutely. Sense.
Despite these characters, these kids are being chased by a murderous clown, but you still relate to them because yeah. they are first and foremost the losers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's I don't know how he does it, but it's amazing.
Well, this is a very new King story. I mean, this is one of the fastest adaptations I think I've seen in a long time. So, I mean, I feel like I just had read it and it's, you know, it's already here. What was your hook for you? What was the hook for this story for you? You know, was it the conceit? Was it just being back in King's Dominion? What was really what pulled you into this?
I think it was the character, first and foremost, Craig being a very imperfect protagonist. He makes a lot of mistakes throughout the story and learns from them and grows from them. But there is a lot of, it's a fairly simple story.
Mm-hmm.
The novella is only 90 pages, but there's a lot of nuance in it. There's no good guy or bad guy. Craig is his own enemy. And I also like that there was a message to it, and there was a point to talking about technology in the film.
Well, when you're talking about the technology, and it's so, you know, it's very strange to watch a movie that's capturing what still seems like a new era, you know, like it's still, I mean, then granted the iPhone is now an appendage of everyone, and the movie pretty much suggests that that's what the future is going to be. But it is interesting to see an era that feels so recent being captured. But, you know, what are your own feelings on the way that we've become sort of enveloped by technology? And is that something that you also have been enveloped by, or do you try to stay off of a little bit? Or, you know, what are just, you know, the relationship to technology in general?
I mean, of course I'm attached to my phone, as yeah. everyone is.
Yeah.
I don't have a serious connection to social media. I'm not too attached to it, but I do find myself scrolling without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to revisit that era where it was, you're sort of on the precipice of it becoming just another part of life. You know, I try to go back to that as much as I can. I try to not be so attached to that thing and be,
yeah.
but you know, it's tough. And no, I think the story gets it right. Even in the end, the main protagonist, he can't even throw the foot. Like he can't yeah. even get rid of the technology. Like, yes, he sees the danger, but he's not this perfect person, and none of us are. We're all attached to it, you know?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's impossible. I was born in 84. And so I got to see kind of like the formation of the internet with like, and I think by 97, I was like, what is this? And then, you know, when playing, you know, going back to it for a second, you know, and being a kid, it's in the 80s, even on set, were you all kind of like, man, this would have been fun. Like,
yeah,
you know,
totally. Yeah. But I think what's also nice about, my personal experience with working on set is that I don't look at my phone ever. Even all the kids on set, and working with Donald as well. I'm not gonna go on my phone between takes. Like, you know, you're always trying to be present. And I love that. Love that. And no, but it was fun to go back to that. I mean, I've tried. It's fun to have tangible things, the romance of like, of finding your friends without texting them or calling them. And like, I'm trying to take notes on a notepad rather than being attached to my phone.
Yeah.
You know, you try to be human and it feels archaic, but it's something, there's something personal about it.
Yeah. I mean, even down to the, like remembering phone numbers. I was,
yeah,
it was something that happened a few weeks ago and my girlfriend was like just rattling out my number and I was like, oh my God, I couldn't list your number. I'm a bad boyfriend. Like, yeah. We just don't have that anymore. It's all reliable on just what's in our phone at this point.
Yeah, it affects your memory as well. Like just how we take pictures now. You can take a picture every day and you have thousands of pictures on your phone. But you look at these I look at pictures of my grandparents and like they have so much power and they're so beautiful because it's a singular item and like this is encapsulates that whole era and there's more weight to it. And now, I mean, who knows if we're gonna look back. I mean, you could scroll through your photo albums, but it's all becomes data. It all becomes less impactful and it's okay to forget things now. I have a terrible memory, but I can look back at what I did. I can tell you what I did every day from last month because I can look back on my photos, but I couldn't tell you right now. And that's kind of a shame.
That's a good point. I haven't thought about that. And it's probably because of that exact point. It's because I haven't had to, you know, it's like this weird catch 22. That's a troubling thought. And I do think back to like, just the, it kind of makes time feel so, it just kind of flattens time a little bit, you know, like even the way that like, if you scroll too fast, it'll be like, wait, which Halloween is this? Is this 2021 or 2020? Like they're all kind of blending together now at this point.
Yeah. You scroll through Instagram for like an hour and I can't tell you one thing that I learned or saw on that. Like,
yeah, it's just an endorphin rush at this point. Right. I will say the one thing it's good for is just music. Cause I love music. Yeah. I love being able to search for music as much as I can.
Spotify is the greatest thing in the world.
It's unreal. Okay. It's like to be out there and be like, God, this day kind of sucks. I kind of want to listen to like, I don't know, something really depressing, or, hey, I'm having a great day. I can put whatever I want. Mm-hmm. But you know, Harry Against Phone gets to that moment where that was all kind of possible. Mm-hmm. And I think that what I love about the film is there are a lot of fun needle drops from that era too. And I was wondering, you know, were these some of the jams that you were growing up with? Were any of these, like, what were some of the first songs that you put on your phone when you got it growing up?
That's a good question. Well, that's funny. There are a lot of good, John picked some great songs to be in this movie, but like there's a Cigar Off song, which I love.
I love that song. Yeah.
Yeah. So good. No, but I remember, first getting an iPod and like having my mom's music on it and my mom's taste and then sort of evolving. I remember the first genre that was like my own was like 90s hip hop, and nice. Discovering like Tribe Called Quest. And so that was like my first venture into music as my own human being, other than what my parents or what older people had taught me about.
What are you listening to these days?
These days, I'm all over the place. The new Steve Lacy album is amazing. Know him. This guy, Alex G.
Oh, yeah.
You like Alex?
Oh, yeah. Great stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I've been into The Cure and like Joy Division lately.
Joy Division's fantastic. I have a tattoo from the Factory Records for Joy Division. I'm just so obsessed with them. Although it's probably not healthy to be that obsessed with Joy Division, but I, you know, incredible music.
Yeah.
Have you been going to concerts again? Because I know that I ask all this because you were also in Meadow Lords and I wanted to get some insights into that perspective too. Cause I know that you got to play with Glenn Sobel a little bit behind the scenes for drumming and kind of want to know what that experience is like and how much that mirrors your real life in terms of interest in music.
I've always been obsessed with music. And have never been able to play it. Like I can't, my brain is not, I'm not musically inclined. But when you're in like a boot camp with someone like Glenn Sobel, you can't help but learn. I mean, when you're doing a movie, you have to learn 3 or 4 songs.
Yeah.
Like the back of your hand. And then now I don't remember any of those songs. I remember the basics of drumming, but I can't can't like pick it up. It's funny.
It's hard. I'm hard. Drumming is so hard. I as growing up, I wanted to play it so bad. And then I think my parents were like, no, please God, don't get a drum set. And then I tried and it's like, I can't do this. I could do maybe this part, but then you have to do the foot. And it's like, no, there's no way this is happening.
It's a very physical thing. And I'm playing guitar now and it's, I don't understand it. My fingers hurt. I'm like, I can't do this. It's too much coordination. But I haven't been going to enough shows. I miss live music.
Do you ever go to fests? Like, did you ever get to go to any of the music fests that are out there?
I went to GovBall recently in New York.
Oh, nice.
A friend of mine was playing and I got to see some cool artists. That was a lot of fun. Post-COVID.
Yeah. Well, you know, I kind of want to talk a little bit about just horror in general, just because it's, you know, we're entering spooky season.
Yeah.
It's a horror movie. Just got to ask, you know, because you're such a big part of this genre now, I mean, especially you're in The Lodge and I swear to God, that movie is incredible and I love it. And I just so dark. That performance is so dark. I remember turning to my girlfriend and just being like, Jesus Christ. What are some of your favorite memories yourself of, you know, growing up with horror? And are there any like, is there like one film or even a book that kind of had a huge effect on you?
It's funny because I've never been that attached to horror. Like I remember The Conjuring being one of my favorites growing up. And then eventually like Hereditary. I like the weirder, more psychological films. But still if I watch a film, it's late at night, I'm probably not gonna pick a horror film. I need to be forced. Needs to be forced upon me.
So more fun to be in them than to watch them.
More fun to be in them because they're not really that scary when you're on set.
Yeah, that's the John Carpenter has a quote that's like it's a blast or something like that. I'm gonna totally botch this quote, but it's like it's a blast to make a horror film. It's a nightmare to make a comedy or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But along those lines, though, I one last question. You know, this movie is a lot about what you learn and take from your elders, and you've worked with just so many iconic Hollywood veterans. I mean, Bill Murray, Donald Sutherland here, Jamie Lee Curtis, even Christopher Lloyd. What do you feel you've learned the most from them? You know, is there one figure that you maybe kind of connected with really, you know, more than the other that you kind of really took away something from working alongside that person?
Yeah, it is incredible to work with these types of actors. And the common theme is that they are very blunt. They're very them. And I think that's a beautiful thing. I mean, you get to a certain age and you've been doing it so long that it's like you don't have to impress anyone anymore. But honestly, Donald was one of the most generous people I've ever worked with. He has so much advice to give, and fortunately he took his time out to offer me some of that advice. Yeah, Donald was very kind. And also all of these people are still doing it and still very passionate about it. And like I'm young, so of course I have the energy and it's my life and my love and my passion. And then to see them and they're obviously been doing this for so long, but they're still it's their lives as well. Like that's who makes it out the other end, you know, the people who are passionate about it.
Well, you've been clearly learning from them because you're killing it. And one of these days you'll be the veteran that's going to be looking, helping out another future Jaden. So, you know, congrats on everything. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me and hopefully speak down on the road.
Thank you so much.
Have a good one. I got some hot friends. God, I got some hot friends. I got some hot friends. God, I got some hot friends. But you know you want somebody to treat you good.
This is the end of our show. For now. Tune in next week If you like our programming, consider searching for other bloody disgusting podcasts, such as Creepy, Horror Queers, The Boo Crew, SCP Archives, Nightlight, Margaret's Garden, and more.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.